Subaltern Podcast with Nikesh Shukla. Download for free off iTunes and thesubaltern.tumblr.com. Follow Nikesh on Twitter at Nikesh Shukla. The Subaltern Podcast.
Welcome to episode 31 of the Subaltern Podcast. We are back. We said episode 30 with James Smythe was our last episode, and by we I mean me, and by me I mean, hi, I'm Nikesh Shukla, and by we're back I mean, welcome to my podcast. This is episode 31, it's with James Salter. I am back, I'm doing more of these interviews with other authors, where we talk about writing, where we talk about their books, where we talk about whatever comes up in conversation. We've got a great lineup of guests for series 3 of the podcast. You know, why don't I just promote some of my own shit, though, while I'm here? Because why not, you know? It's free content for you guys. I have some short stories out in various places that you should go and check out. Issue 28 of Five Dials has got a short story that I wrote from the perspective of a henchman who gets dispatched very quickly in the film Total Recall. And by the film Total Recall, I mean the original starring Get Your Ass to Mars, Arnold Schwarzenegger. I also have a short story called The Man with the Golden Arm in issue 3 of Teller magazine, beautifully illustrated by a guy called Lewis. That's about superheroes and disability and about Bombay. And I also have a short story called Canute, which is about spearfishing in the new issue of in the new anthology, the best of Best British Short Stories 2013. Apparently my short story was one of the best short stories in 2013, apparently. So there you go, fishing, superheroes and sci-fi films. Don't call me not diverse, because I'm brown and that makes me very diverse. So to today's episode, because I could spend a lot longer promoting my stuff. Why not? But I think, you know, let's get back to where we are with who I'm. Can you tell it's been a while? You know, new listeners are probably like, who the hell is this guy? Why is he talking? He should just get to the interview. We downloaded this podcast for the interview. But, you know, while we're here, the Subaltern Podcast, we need comments from people like you, especially good ones, am I right, guys? You know, click 5-star, click 4 stars on the iTunes rating thing or on Stitcher or wherever you're listening to it. Just, you know, show us some love and, you know, I can keep doing these interviews. I've got people like George Saunders in the future. I've got people like Taye Selassie. I've got Sam Byers, Sam Bain, all the Sams. I'm hoping to do Sam Beckett in the future. From Quantum Leap. Okay, anyway, episode 31 is with James Salter. James Salter is incredible. He wrote one of my favourite books, Light Years. He also wrote All That Is, which recently came out, and is a great return to form since his last novel was in 1979. That's 30-odd years to live a life that he can then write about, because this kind of feels, you know, for someone who's written a lot of memoir, this sort of feels like the memoir of a previous editor that James had. I don't know. We talk about it a little bit in the podcast. He's very cool. I explained my book and why it was called Coconut Unlimited to him before the interview started, and the sort of the premise behind the podcast. And when I explained to him what a coconut was, you know, white on the inside, brown on the outside, he said maybe I should rename the podcast The Coconut Kid, which made me laugh. He's a very charming man, very nice guy as well. So thanks to Picador for letting me talk to him for our allotted 25 minutes. And I hope you enjoy the podcast. Come back next week. Leave me some comments. Follow me on Twitter at Nikesh Shukla. Just tell your friends about this podcast, man. I mean, you know, pay it forward. Show me some love. I like attention. Episode 31 of the Subaltern Podcast, James Salter. Okay, so welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
So it's been 30-odd years since the last novel, and just wanted to know how come you decided to write a novel now, having had your last one out in...
Well, there's nothing really significant about that. I was writing stories, I was writing other things. I wrote an autobiography, and I just felt it was time to, not that it was time, I just felt like writing something bigger. I am a novelist, I've written before, so...
And is it one of those things like a bicycle where you never really forget how to write a novel, or was it quite difficult having written stories and memoir pieces for so long?
Well, it's no more difficult than any other time. It's always difficult. It's always the first time, at least for me. But there was nothing especially difficult. I was not rusty, so to speak, or could not remember how to spell. I simply set out about it.
And was it something that you had been planning all these years? Was it the novel that you were always going to write, or had you started other things in that time?
Yeah, that would put a very heavy weight on it, wouldn't it, if it were the book of my life. In a way, it is the book of my life, because, as you know, it covers the period from the end of the war to up into the 80s, probably. Mm. That whole time span, and in a number of places. But it's not a book I planned on all my life. I would say it was a book I felt I was ready to write, this particular one. It's about book editors. A book editor is the hero of it, the principal figure of it. And I respected them. A number of them were my friends. Hadn't been. That was in the second part of my life, I would say. I began to know editors, and some became pretty close friends. And I liked their life. I admired it. It seemed on a level that was really comfortable between commerce, between the practical world and the intellectual world. They traveled. They had dinners and lunches. Their company was interesting. And of course, they're dealing in books all the time. So that was it. I picked one, and this is his life.
One of the key lines for me about Bowman was at some point you said Bowman was happy, or felt that he was happy, and I really like that idea that he knew what it felt to be happy, but never quite gets to that point where he does feel happy. And I wonder, do you feel that Bowman understands happiness?
I don't know. I felt like writing that, because when you're happy, there's also the consciousness that it's only temporary, probably. You're related, but there's another level of your existence you're probably going to resume. Mm. It's not particularly significant. It's just I thought it described something. I'm not prepared to describe it in other terms.
And was Bowman based on a particular editor that you knew, or...?
Well, largely on a couple of them. His widow didn't recognize him.
Oh, really?
Yes. So, you know, he was altered a bit. One of the figures he's based on died some years ago, but it exists very clearly in my memory.
Was he someone that you had worked with?
Yes. And I'm writing him from my memory. I didn't do any research on him. I didn't take anything really literally from his life. I just took what I had. And I had quite a bit about him that I had thought, remembered, felt. And that was largely half of the character.
And have you revisited any of your old work? Do they still feel like books that you wrote, or do they feel like books from another part of your life?
Well, I rarely revisit them, but occasionally, I don't know what makes you do that. In the evening, you might pass the bookshelf and take one and look at it for a page or two. Oh, especially if somebody's been talking about it, talking to you about it, or has been mentioned somehow. Do they seem like another life and another writer? No, not particularly. I would say I recognize my own sentences and my own, for want of a better word, rhythms, or my own, you know, my own voice in there.
So is that something that you feel has stayed constant, is your own voice? It hasn't.
I don't believe it's going to become more mature.
I remember reading once that you wrote, "I decided to write or perish."
Yes.
Do you still stand by that?
Yeah, well, that was a stupid word to use, a much loftier word than necessary. I should have. I really meant to say I decided to swim or sink is more like it. But since I decided to write, I was either going to somehow be a writer or simply abandon my life in a way and take up another life somehow. I had no idea what that would be, and I didn't intend to do it. So I said perish. I mean, write or die would be closer to it.
I'm quite interested in the idea that you had this whole lifetime, this career, before you started writing. And do you think that gave you a greater perspective on life and what you would then go on to write than if you had straight out of school picked up a pen and started to write?
Yes, well, I think you write differently after you've been in the world for 10 years than you do when you get out of school. It's inevitable. Certainly I was a different person than I was at 20, 21. I don't know anything particularly significant about the fact that it was military world that I was involved in. It was really just a process of rubbing shoulders with your countrymen that you would never have met before, with people you wouldn't have met, and ideas that are alien, habits that are alien to you. And also there's the normal jostling of life. You have problems, crises, angers, things to settle, ambitions thwarted, all that. That's all making you, I suppose, a different person, but not substantially. I mean, there's nothing magical about it. It's going out into the world, that's all.
And before I ask the next question, I just wanted to ask, just to sort of set up the next question in a way, do you ever find that people project their own experiences on your work, and therefore they might misread the words you've written and the themes that you're trying to explore?
Oh, definitely.
So with that caveat, towards the end of the book, you write that the power of the novel and the the power of the novel and the nation's culture had weakened. Do you see the power of books and literature has diminished in the world today? Do you see that happening?
Yes, I suppose, but your opinion shifts all the time. When I wrote that, which was perhaps a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, it seemed right for me, for Bowman. Those are not his words.
Yeah.
Those words are in the text. There may be some feeling that those are his thoughts, but can't be directly attributed to him. So I think what I felt is that that world, that way of life that he represented, the golden age of publishing, smaller publishing houses, and no alternative publishing world, which we have today. You have the digital world, you have private publishing, that is to say, personal publishing. All that really didn't exist. And but it was coming, and he felt that the traditional power of the novel published by a publishing house was probably weakening, was lessening. But that paragraph, of course, is really qualified by the line, it was all happening, and everybody went on exactly as before. And it says, that was the beautiful part of it, which really is a comment on the entire paragraph.
I always feel in this country particularly, books gave way to rock and roll, and rock and roll gave way to football, and footballers are now held up with the same, soccer players are held up with the same reverence that authors were in the sort of the 50s and 60s, and it's an interesting cultural shift for me. I think
we have had the same shift. Everything is given away to music. In a very big way, but it hasn't given away to football in America. Football is a big thing, but basketball and baseball really compete with it. Film and television, of course, which didn't exist at the beginning. After the war, they were born. Not film, of course, that went back before, but a certain video, film, images, all that. Images and music, I think, have been the big, have been the point, the arrowhead of culture.
And do you ever miss working in film?
No.
Would say you would never go back and...
They wouldn't have me back.
Why not?
So it's an easy...
Is that a medium that you keep up to date with?
Not particularly. But the reason I say that is I hate going to the movie theater. They become different sort of places than the ones that I associate with movies. There are a lot of advertisements. There are endless previews, 20 minutes of previews, of fast cut previews. There's music, they're selling candy in the place. I rather like the theaters like the Museum of Modern Art, which is kind of a gray, neutral, quiet, contemplative box, comfortable seats, perhaps 200 people, and it's sort of a religious experience. Well, the screen lights up gradually, and you see the film, nothing more. You know what film it's going to be, of course. It's been thoroughly described in all the literature. Now, that's seeing movies, in my view. The rest of it is just submerging yourself in the mob. And, you know, I'm too cranky to do that now.
I must say, the one thing that I do miss from the films is the sound of the projector flickering through the...
That's nice, isn't it? The clack, clack, or whatever it is.
And I find that I seem to romanticise noises like that, and that's why I still buy records, because I like the sound of the crackle of the vinyl before the song plays.
Yes.
And, you know, and that's why I like reading books, you know, the sound of the
of the paper.
Yeah, there's this oral quality to these things that I miss.
And well, the feel of the paper is wonderful too, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't know if it's just something we're used to, or whether this is a deeply human, you know, a tangible need to feel the paper. So many hints that it's all going to be digital in the future make me wonder. But most people agree there'll always be books, there'll always be paper books, even though only for the vinyl record people.
Yeah. Well, I always find it interesting that you have all this technology that's supposed to bring us together, but actually the pieces of technology are quite distancing, so that the phone has become quite a distancing object, the computer screen, how we're constantly connected but we're never really interacting. It doesn't feel human anymore. It doesn't feel like the crinkle of the paper or the whirring of the projector.
You know, I really can't talk about this intelligently, because I don't have an iPhone and I don't have an iPad. I mean, I know what they are. I do have an iPod, which is a fabulous device. I mean, but I noticed that everybody is texting and talking constantly. So even though this idea is that they're separated by technology in a way, that they never really get to sit down and with somebody face to face, I don't know if that's true or not, because I went for a sandwich yesterday at lunch. Outside, a couple of girls sat down. They immediately pulled out their phones. I mean, this is normal everywhere. And they started talking, texting. So they weren't lonely. What's the alternative to that? 25 years ago, they came and they sat down. And if they weren't talking to one another, they just sat there and ate their lunch and thought about things. So I'm not sure that technology has really separated people. I said I'm not qualified to talk about it, but I'm talking about it. I don't know. Your opinion is more valid in every way than mine. But you know, if you're in a little town, I have been in small towns in my life, where on Sunday in a small town, everything is closed. People have gone to church. Now they're back home. They're eating or something. You're an outsider to all this. You don't live there. Or maybe, even if you do, your possibilities of talking to anyone or seeing anyone or of having any contact are very, very limited. You have a book, if you like, or you might listen to or look at television, but now you can easily talk to your friends or make new friends, as a matter of fact. They may be partly imaginary, that is, you've never met them. You really don't know what they're like, but you know what they talk like and what they think like to a certain degree. I think that's a rather marvelous thing. Everybody, there's no longer complete isolation unless you're in a place where there's no technology at all, where there's simply not a society that supports it, or it's so poor that nobody can afford it. I've talked on endlessly about something that I don't know about.
And you sound, you're making complete sense, so talk more about it. So I'm just aware of time, so I'll just ask you a couple more questions, if that's okay.
We have plenty of time. You're going to edit this, I presume.
If I can find anything that needs editing. Straight gold, James.
All right.
Sorry, Mr. Salter. How aware are you of your status as a writer, are you? Because you're often described as the writer's writer, or, you know, and I've read some articles where they described you as one of the best writers that people haven't read. Is this something that you're aware of, and how do you feel about that pigeonhole?
Well, I'm aware that I don't sell very well. That's about the... I don't think of it in any other terms. That's a very important thing. It's a question of visibility, really. If you have a very limited number of readers, that's what you're going to be. They say a writer's writer. I presume that's because writers know about me, but the general public doesn't. It's a pathetic idea.
Yeah, because I don't think I came across you because a writer told me that this is a book you should read. I came across you because you were just in the library next to other authors that I adored, and you know, you just move on through the books of.
Well, not many people do that. Unfortunately, I'm next to Salinger, and to someone. What's the other writer? S. Anyway, two big sellers. And so usually there's not much room for a book of mine on the shelf with them. And also, for some reason, the S's are usually down at the bottom, on the bottom shelf. This is all foolishness.
But I have that problem as well, because I'm S, and yeah. I'm next to Lionel Shriver and Gary Steingart.
Ah, so you have the same problem.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, they've either got to, some, well... No solution for that.
So I couldn't let you go without getting some writing advice from you. I'm currently working on my second novel, going through the second novel blues, as it were, and I just wanted to know what keeps you writing.
There's nothing else. Well, I mean, by this time I'm a writer. It's my life. I think like a writer. I'm prepared to be a writer. Writing is a comfort to me, and also it's something I do automatically. I don't have to say, now you must think about writing something. I'm usually writing something most of the time, not part of a book, not part of a story necessarily, but something I don't want to forget or something that's occurred to me. So I don't have to begin, really. You do have to begin a novel. You do have to plan it out. There was a thing published the other day, I think, in America. I think it was in the Huffington Post, I'm not sure, of outlines of various writers. And I always thought of myself as a very organized person and made intricate outlines. But I looked at them all, and mine was the worst of any of them, except for Henry Miller. His was an astrological chart of some nature. I mean, loony. But the rest of them were in much more detail than mine. So I see, I can improve.
Don't think you need to. Thank you so much for being
here. It's a pleasure. Nice talking to you.
And that was a podcast, guys. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. I know it's been a while since I've done this, and I was starting to get a bit slick before, but now I'm back to sort of my sort of semi-shambolic ways. Guys, come back next week. Follow me on Twitter at Nika Shukla. Buy All That Is by James Salter. Download the podcast on iTunes, on Stitcher, from Podomatic, wherever you might find it. Take care. Have a good time with your lives. Bye.